dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder and president of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the war of ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for what I think of as an intelligence briefing on the war for the free world. It's always a treat to be able to speak to someone who is deeply diving into a very important national security and, indeed, intelligence matter, I think. He is Luke Rosiak. He is an investigative reporter with the Daily Caller News Foundation, and he is one of very few people who is carefully, thoroughly, and systematically focused on a scandal on Capitol Hill. It's the subject of my commentary today as well, but we're going to cover what's the latest from Luke Rosiak's reporting with him now. Luke, thank you so much for coming back. It's great to have you with us.
Thank you, Frank.
Let's start with just sort of a 101 level introduction to the scandal that you have uncovered in the House Democratic Caucus with respect to how its members have had their IT operations run by some dubious characters.
Well, it's a complicated story, but on February 2nd, Capitol Police said that the IT guys, these five IT guys working for a couple dozen Democratic members of Congress, were criminal suspects in a theft and information security criminal probe, and that the Capitol Police and the Sergeant at Arms were banning them from the House complex, and they weren't allowed to touch the computers. Although they were not being arrested at that time, they said it was an ongoing criminal investigation. So I named them, and there are these five Pakistanis. Imran Awan is the name of the oldest brother, and he started working for Debbie Wasserman Schultz and some other House members over a decade ago. And shortly after, his relatives started appearing on the payroll, and they were all making the maximum salary of about $165,000 a year. So it added up
for
to
IT
about
services.
$5 million. Right, and that's much higher than most IT guys make. So they collected at least $5 million in taxpayer funds just in the salaries of these five people. So that if some of those were ghost employees, that may be one component of the investigation, but they also say that they were violating the law in terms of information security. It seems like they were taking information from the House and putting it onto an offsite server. And basically, no one really had any idea what they were doing because they're the IT guys. They're pretty much the only person with any technical knowledge in some of these offices.
So let's talk a little bit about the information that may have been expropriated by these guys and how they were able to do it without leaving fingerprints.
Well, it's pretty easy when you're the only guy that has any technical knowledge. The rest of these people are policy staffers, and they don't really know what you're doing. Basically, they had full access to every email that was sent and received by these dozens of members of Congress and every file that was on the hard drives of any of their staff members.
Now, is there reason to believe that there was classified information in those files and databases, Luke Rosiak,
or is it
simply sensitive information that could actually be a problem for the members of Congress and maybe even for our security just the same?
I think it was sensitive information that could easily open lawmakers to blackmail and extortion. Any email that politically looks bad, it's very easy to get a member of Congress in a position where they're you catch them trying to appease one interest group. I mean, just think about all the games of political gotcha. I mean, it's very easy to see the simple ways in which if you could read every email that a lawmaker wrote, you could easily find some things that they would be really scared for their job. And at that point, you've really got them over a barrel.
Well, and of course, it's not just the emails that they wrote. It's the emails that are coming into their email boxes from their own staff or from constituents or from others as well. Your story of the other day, Luke, talked about how the central information technology system of the House gave Imran Awan extraordinary access to this information without having to go through the, as you put it, paper trail about the unusually high permissions he was requesting. Talk a little bit about the implications of that, if you would.
Well, the House has a central office, central IT, basically, that has to authorize the various IT guys that work for individual members of Congress. So this guy Imran was working for a handful of members, and then he had all these relatives who were ostensibly working for a bunch of members each themselves, although it seems likely that probably one or two of the brothers was doing most of the work, and the other ones were potentially just sort of straw employees to collect the paycheck, since the other ones were already hitting the maximum allowed salary. So he may have been asking for access for offices where he didn't even work, so that he could do work for, you know, in his brother's names and things like that. He also had his wife on the payroll and his brother's wife. And, he didn't want there to be a paper trail. It could have been just the sloppiness and the theft of the ghost employees, or it could have been something more. But certainly he had access, and this is what the central IT guy told me, not that it's surprising, is that the IT guys in the members' offices were the ones setting up the staff and the members' email accounts and the user privileges. So naturally, they were super users, and they could see anything in anyone's account.
Let me just ask you, Luke, as you have been drilling down on this as much as possible, it's obviously under an ongoing investigation. There seems to have been little effort been made, at least so far, by the appropriate House committees, oversight committees, and the like, even though members of some of the most sensitive committees in the Congress were the subject of these potential penetrations, I guess is one way to put it. Do you have any evidence, Luke, or have you had anyone talk with you about the possibility that perhaps there were foreign intelligence services at work here that that may have been the beneficiary of this penetration?
No, I mean, the truth is that the members of Congress seem to just want this to go away, as if it's just some kind of annoying political scandal.
If they're the subject of the investigation, but are you saying that the Republicans, these are all Democrats after all, the Republicans just want it to go away, that they're not doing an investigation of it? I can't imagine that would be the case if the roles were reversed.
Yeah, that's an interesting point. I mean, clearly these committees are run by Republicans, but that's the truth is that the Republicans haven't shown any real interest in this, at least not publicly. I mean, maybe they're being really secretive about it and they're doing something, some kind of investigation. But I mean, I've asked the Republicans on the House Oversight Committee, and you know, I've asked the House Administration Committee, and everyone just wants to punt to someone else, and it's you know, primarily the Capitol Police that they punt to, and that's probably the least equipped body of all, because we're dealing with potential flight risks. There's one fugitive involved already. We're dealing with forensic, digital forensics, and the Capitol Police, they really don't have the ability to examine hard drives and, you know, do network traces and things like that. I mean,
why isn't the FBI all over this? This would seem to me to be a prime counterintelligence problem that they should be investigating at that level, shouldn't it?
Yeah, I think they should be. And, you know, there seems to be a push to kind of cast this as primarily a theft issue. No one denies that these five Pakistani brothers have, you know, full access to all the files and are criminal suspects. But they seem to be trying to say, you know, the main issue here is theft of money. But there's really no way to know that if the only people investigating are the Capitol Police. I mean, the Capitol Police don't have the ability to determine whether there's an information theft problem. So I don't know. Maybe the members, the legislative branch is kind of territorial, and maybe it's kind of just a turf thing, and they say we want to keep this within the legislative branch, or maybe they don't want a scandal that will make a lot of, at the minimum, make a lot of members of Congress look a little gullible and silly and, you know, having failed to vet some of their own staff.
Well, and it may have something to do with the fact that these folks are all Muslim and from Pakistan, and those sorts of potential embarrassments, I think, or political liabilities may be operating as well. I've had a senior member of the House tell me that he's been told that they just have to wait for the investigation to be completed, and then they'll get on to oversight investigations. But I hope, as your reporting suggests, Luke, that there isn't a loss of forensic information or some of the suspects in the meantime. Luke, I really appreciate the work you're doing on all of this at the Daily Caller News Foundation. Luke Rosiak is our guest. Check out his reporting on it. Keep up the good work, my friend. Come back to us again with updates very soon, if you would. Next up, the great historian and faith leader, David Barton, joins us. We'll talk about Sharia supremacism, past and present. That and more straight ahead.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney. You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
Welcome back. It is the greatest of pleasure to say that we have in the House, virtually at least, a man I've come to admire tremendously. He is David Barton, the founder of a terrific organization based out of Texas, Wall Builders. He is, though, a man of many parts. He has been very active in education as a trained historian. The author of some 31 books on all sorts of topics of relevance to the national interest and much of it the national security as well. He is also one of the leaders of a terrific organization I'm very proud to be supporting, the Faith Leaders for America. And it's, I think, his first visit with us here at Secure Freedom Radio, and I couldn't be more pleased. David Barton, welcome, sir.
Brayden, thanks for having me on. Sure appreciate what you do, brother. Thank you.
Thank you for all that you do. I want to talk a little bit about some of what you've done over the years, David, and that is particularly informed by history and the experience of Thomas Jefferson back in the days when he confronted Sharia supremacism in the form of the Barbary pirates. Talk a little bit about that that moment and its relevance for our own time.
Yeah, that moment represents a huge philosophical shift in American public policy and constitutional policy. When we finished the American Revolution, we ended up creating a constitution that prohibited any standing army. We're not allowed to have a permanent military in America. To this day, we do not. We use the National Defense Authorization Act to refund the military from the ground up totally every 2 years. If we don't make that funding, there is no American military. And that changed because of Muslim terrorists, because starting in 1784, Muslim terrorists began attacking Americans overseas. And the Founding Fathers thought, you know, if anybody ever attacks us, we'll do exactly what we did to Great Britain. We'll grab our guns. They'll be in trouble. But we'd never thought about, what do you do when American citizens get attacked elsewhere?
We're visiting with David Barton, an historian and constitutional scholar and activist with Wall Builders. Please continue your thought on this lessons of the Barbary Pirates experience.
So we're barely done with the Revolution before. In 1784, Congress dispatches three famous Americans, John Adams, Thomas Jefferson, and Ben Franklin, to go negotiate with five Muslim nations that are attacking Americans overseas. After 2 years of attacks, Thomas Jefferson and John Adams have developed a relationship with one of those Muslim ambassadors. And they ask him, they say, you know, we don't understand this. These are all unprovoked attacks. We've done absolutely nothing to you guys. What is this? And in a letter that's recorded in the State Department, still available on their website, they tell Jefferson Adams that, well, we do this because it's required by the Quran. We have to do this. We're supposed to subdue all the other nations, and we're supposed to make them slaves. And if we do that, we go to heaven. And so Adams and Jefferson kind of look at each other and say, you go to heaven for killing people? And that's when they both bought their first Koran, and they got that Koran while they were in London, two volumes set for each of them, and they read through and said, my gosh, what religion is it that says you go to heaven for killing people? And so that started shaping their thinking, and we were unable to defend these Americans overseas, so what we started doing was paying tribute. We would pay up to $1 million at a whack to each of these five countries, and they'd say, we want three frigates, and we want $1 million. And we would do that, and it still didn't stop the attacks. So in 1795, George Washington addressed Congress and said, give me some money to have a navy. If you give me a navy, he said, I'll crush these enemies of mankind into non-existence. And so that's where we funded the Navy for the first time. It's our first thought of having a permanent military because we've got Americans to protect overseas. John Adams builds the Navy. When John Adams builds the Navy, he does not use it to go free Americans because he said, I know these guys, I know Muslim terrorists. If we get in a fight with them, it'll be a long fight, and Americans don't have a stomach for a long fight because that's what these guys will require. This is a philosophy with them. Then Jefferson does get the Navy. When he gets it, up to that point, we have been averaging 10% a year in trying to deal with Muslim terrorists. 10% of the entire federal budget every year since George Washington is dealing with Muslim terrorists. And Jefferson loads up the Marines on the Navy, brand new Navy ships, sends them, and under General William Eaton, the Marines and the Navy marched through all of North Africa, across what we now call Libya. They go through those five nations. The shores of Tripoli, Halsa Montezuma, the shores of Tripoli. And by the way, that's where our Marines get the name Leathernecks, because while they were there, they said, you know, these Muslim guys really like beheading people. And so they literally put leather around their necks to protect their necks from beheading when they were in the battle with the Muslims. And so that's where they get the name Leathernecks. And to this day, a leather collar is still part of the official U.S. Marine dress uniform.
David Barton, let me just ask you, because I want to make sure we cover a couple of other topics quickly here. When you fast forward this kind of jihadism and the belief that everyone must submit and be forced to do so through jihad if possible, it's playing out today, of course, in a very profound and genocidal fashion. You've been involved with a group called the Nazarene Fund to try to help particularly Christians being victimized in that regard. Talk a bit about the work of the Nazarene Fund. And
it's the same thing as 200 years ago, is these Sharia supremacists attack everybody that's not them and kill or subdue them. And so what we do with the Nazarene Fund is try to rescue Christians and other religious minorities that are being attacked by ISIS-like Sharia supremacists all across the Middle East. It's a massive genocide. President Obama finally in his last year admitted it was a genocide. That changes our policy and what we can do. But in that period of time, what we were doing was going into into Iraq and Syria and places like that ahead of ISIS. And we moved out about 14,000 folks. Some went to overseas. Some we moved to safer places in the nation. Brazil and Australia and Canada took refugees. Of course, American wouldn't take them because they were Christian. We're happy to take Somalian Muslims, 100,000. But I think we took a total of 53 or 55 Christians after the genocide declaration. So that's what Nazarene Fund does, is we move these people out. In the 60s, there were 30 million Christians in the Middle East. Today, there's less than 500,000. That's the size of the genocide that's been going on over there. Averaging about 90,000 Christians a year being killed, and it's an ugly part of world history, but it's just not being covered in America.
It certainly isn't, and your efforts, those of the Nazarene Fund, and I know you're getting help from Glenn Beck and Mercury One in its work, and I commend you for it. It's tremendously important and a model, it seems to me, for what an awful lot of others, including the church itself, ought to be doing. Let me ask you about one other piece of this with your historian's perspective, David Barton, and that is the trends in Europe, where you're seeing this mass migration, Hijra, as it's called, much of it from the Middle East and Africa. You have documented in our own history the rise of secularism, the influence of socialism, transnationalism, all of which are very much in evidence, of course, in Europe at the moment. To what extent, David Barton, do you see those creating conditions that are making the perils for Western civilization from these Sharia supremacists all the greater?
They're fairly intense, and they're growing in America in a way that we've never seen before. And it really is because America has forgotten, and now it really doesn't know much about its own history that causes for it. We were so different from Europe that back in the day, Thomas Jefferson said that the comparison of our government with those of Europe is a comparison of heaven and hell. And that was his analogy. And today, we have a justice in the U.S. Supreme Court, Breyer, who just wrote a book that said, hey, we need to be like Europe. We got to get away from this constitution we've got, be like everybody else. Ginsburg travels the world saying, hey, other nations, do not copy the American Constitution. What you want is the South African Constitution, etc. We've got all these guys saying, let's be like Europe. And no, let's not be like Europe. The average constitution in the history of the world lasts 17 years. Our Constitution so far is 229 years. I'll take that any time over 17.
Especially with the contents of it as well, and you've done so much to defend it over the course of the years. David Barton, we are hard out of time, but hardly out of topics to discuss. I hope you'll join us again soon. Thank you so much for your time and the great work you do at Wall Builders. Next up, we'll talk with Michael Cutler about immigration and more. Straight ahead.
Now more with Frank Gaffney.
We're back. We're joined, as we often are, by Michael Cutler, a distinguished former Immigration and Naturalization Service official who for 30 years helped protect our country's borders and assure interior enforcement of our laws, as well as worked closely with agencies in New York City, the criminal investigation of terrorism and countering drug trafficking and the like. These days, we find him as a senior fellow at the Californians for Population Stabilization, a terrific organization. He is also a very frequent contributor to the public policy debate, notably at Front Page Magazine, Family Security Matters, and of course, here at Secure Freedom Radio, among other places. Michael Cutler, welcome back. It's so good to have you.
Good to join you, Frank.
Let's talk a little bit about the latest developments, Michael, on the immigration and border security fronts, perhaps starting with the president's executive orders, now two of them, with respect to the effort to pause immigration from countries that even President Obama deemed were problematic. Talk a little bit about where that stands.
You know, what's remarkable, if you look at the way these judges ruled on the first one, we'll see what happens now with the 2.0 version. The president has the authority. You know, there's a section of the Immigration Act, Title 8, United States Code, Section 1182, Section F, that says very simply, it's two sentences, whenever the president, now mind you, just the president, right, whenever the president finds that the entry of any aliens or any class of aliens into the United States would be detrimental to the interests of the United States, and that's a low bar. Doesn't say they have nuclear weapons or they suffer the Ebola virus. If they simply, in the judgment of the president, would be detrimental to the interests of the United States, he may by proclamation, and for such period as he shall deem necessary, suspend the entry of all aliens or any class of aliens as immigrants or non-immigrants, or impose on the entry of aliens any restrictions that he may deem to be appropriate.
Now, Michael Cutler, were these provisions that were exercised by previous presidents? This was not something that was just enacted for Donald Trump's use, was it?
No, this has been part of the immigration laws for decades. Jimmy Carter did it after our embassy was overrun in 1980. In fact, when I was an INS agent back there, just about every agent in the New York office was told, drop all of your casework. Your job is to go out specifically and look for Iranians 100% of the time. And if they're here legally, illegally, they're to be questioned. You're to determine if they are, part of an insurgency, if they're involved in subversive or terrorist activities.
And this was, of course, a Democratic president of the United States, Jimmy Carter. And I gather that really the subsequent presidents used this authority as well, including Barack Obama, of course. So, Michael, if in fact the courts once again interpose an objection, and one could happen very shortly because there's an effort to stay this new 2.0 version, as you say, before it goes into effect on Thursday, what are the implications, both on the ground as you see it and for presidential authority in a rather important area?
Look, these judges don't get the president's daily brief. I remember years ago when I was up at DEA intelligence, we uncovered apparent Colombian terrorists operating in the United States. Terrorists come from all over the world. They were found with bomb detonators in their trunk. And I wrote a segment of what became part of the president's daily brief the following morning. It was an exciting thing to be part of. So the president sits in the Oval Office. In comes a team of intelligence officials who brief the president. Now imagine what happens if one morning, God forbid, in comes the team and they say, Mr. President, we have information from wiretaps and electronic surveillance that there's a team of terrorists with passports from six countries. We don't know their names. We know they're heading to America with nuclear weapons or biological weapons, and we need to do everything we can to prevent this from happening. And he says, okay, great. What are the countries? They give him the list of countries. He says, fine. Order all ports of entry. No one from those countries gets in till we can sort this out and figure out who the terrorists are.
Hmm. an immigration pause, if you will. Only he wouldn't be allowed to do it under the precedents that are now being established. Yeah, this is extraordinarily troubling, isn't it?
But think of how dangerous that is.
Yeah.
It's not being reported that way.
Yeah. No, it's as though these judges have the authority to unmake the law, and for that matter, the constitutional authority that resides in the commander-in-chief.
And by the way, speaking of the Constitution, I'm glad you said that. You're right on key. Article 4, Section 4 of the United States Constitution says that the president, well, here it is. I'll read it. It's a sentence. The United States shall guarantee to every state in this union a republican form of government and shall protect each of them against invasion and on application of the legislature or of the executive when the legislature cannot be convened. That's how significant the president can act unilaterally, right, against domestic violence. Is that not what the president is trying to do right now?
Well, and what we expect him to do, more to the point. Let me ask you about a related subject. And Michael Cutler, again, is our guest and has had a long experience with the sorts of issues that are now very much in play. Specifically, another executive order of the president with respect to those in this country illegally who have been associated with or directly responsible for criminal activity. There's a lot of bad press going at the president on this count as well, and very critical of some of your former colleagues for enforcing that order. Give us a sense, Michael, from your vantage point as an experienced hand at these things, as well as a veteran now outside of government. Are they doing the job we expect them to do in terms of interior enforcement of the law, and how important is it that they do that job?
Interior enforcement has always been the critical issue. Look, we have millions of people inside the United States. Some ran the border. They evaded the inspections process. You know, the open borders, immigration anarchists say, oh, they're undocumented. No, they're uninspected. They snuck in, and it's remarkable. Chuck Schumer, ringleader of the Gang of Eight, or eight gangsters, as I prefer to call them, has been adamant that when people trespass on landmarks or critical infrastructure, there should be a federal law that puts them in jail for 5 years. Think about that. In New York City, he talked about a 16-year-old boy who's showing very little common sense, climbed the Trade Center when it was under construction to take a selfie. And he used that kid as one of his examples for why this should be a 5-year crime. Oh, it's dangerous. Okay. But when people trespass on America, he wants to give them citizenship.
The last time I checked, Michael Cutler, including across national park lands, among other things, right?
Right. So understand this. There's no way to interview millions of people. We don't know who they are. We don't even have a record of their entry. This undermines national security. You know, I'm a huge fan of the U.S. military. Could not be a bigger fan. The Navy has this great commercial, right? I'm sure you've seen it. These guys stand there with their arms folded across their burly chests. To get to you, they got to get through us. Well, the 9/11 hijackers did not come here on U-boats. They came on commercial airline flights. And so when we have millions of people in the country, we don't know who they are, think of the risk. On 9/11, 19 young men barely out of their teens inflicted more casualties on the United States of America, on the mainland, in New York, in Washington, in Pennsylvania, than did the entire Japanese fleet at Pearl Harbor on December 7th, 1941. And the key is interior enforcement of the immigration laws. Unfortunately, you now have lots of ICE agents who've never enforced the immigration laws. They came on since George Bush and Barack Obama. Bush did everything he could when he reconfigured immigration to stymie immigration efforts, believe it or not. John Hostetler, and I've written about this in all those websites we've talked about, said that the way they created DHS prevented securing the border, prevented effective immigration enforcement. Trump comes along and finally says, we need to triple the number of ICE agents. And he did something interesting with his executive order that's getting very little play. It's important, and I said this to Al D'Amato when he was our senator from New York, and we created the aggravated felon reentry law, which makes unlawful reentry by criminals a 20-year max felony. Very successful law, by the way, back in the 80s. I said, you can't only focus on criminals, but that should be the thrust of the effort. Because otherwise, number one, you're undermining the purpose of our immigration laws to ignore people who run the border. And again, the 9/11 Commission found first and foremost it was failures of the immigration system that enabled the terrorists to enter the United States and embed themselves as well as criminals. But it's also a matter of telling agents that even if you arrest an illegal alien, there's no such thing as a protected group, which is what Obama did.
Michael Cutler, we are hard out of time. There's so much more to talk about. From the Californians for Population Stabilization, you can follow Michael Cutler's work at Family Security Matters and Front Page Magazine, as well as here at Secure Freedom Radio. Michael, thank you so much for joining us. Next up, we'll speak with Gordon Chang about developments in Asia and more straight ahead.
Go to SecureFreedomRadio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio. Go to SecureFreedomRadio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
Welcome back. Our guest this time each week, we're very privileged to say, is Gordon Chang, one of the country's foremost experts on China, the Far East more generally, and our relationship therewith, and the security implications most especially of the dynamics that are now unfolding before our eyes, it seems more and more dramatically by the day. Gordon, welcome back to Secure Freedom Radio. It's always good to have you with us.
Thank you so much, Frank.
We have the Secretary of State, Rex Tillerson, heading off for his first trip to Asia. I doubt it will be his last, but it's one that is clearly overshadowed at the moment by very, very ominous developments out of North Korea. You have, of course, written a definitive book on the subject of this dynasty in North Korea entitled Nuclear Showdown, North Korea Takes on the World. It seems to be doing a lot of that at the moment. Tell us sort of the latest and what Tillerson is likely to find from his interactions with our allies in the region.
Well, Tillerson's going to Japan, South Korea, and China. And as you signal, North Korea is going to be the top of the list of the things that he needs to talk about. China right now is showing alarm about what's happening on the Korean Peninsula. And it's not just its concern over the deployment of the THAAD anti-missile system in South Korea. It's, I think, really started because of the problems that it sees inside the regime in Pyongyang. Last month, there were many instances of instability. And I think that it is starting to bother the Chinese. Also, we're seeing that the Trump administration is reacting. It's sending over nuclear-capable B-1, B-2 bombers. The F-35B is going to the Korean Peninsula for the first time. The SEAL team that took out Osama bin Laden is now part of the big exercises on the Korean Peninsula with South Korea. So I think that there is a real sense on both sides of this that North Korea is unstable, it could do something extremely dangerous, and that both sides need to try to ensure some way of stability, though they're not coordinating, and I think that that's a good thing in a sense. But nonetheless, we are seeing real concern.
One of the things that we've been discussing, you and I, and that to my astonishment, frankly, in the aftermath of this salvo of missiles a week or so ago by the North Koreans, the Trump administration moved immediately to begin the deployment of this terminal high-altitude area defense. Talk a little bit about how that system is now playing out in domestic South Korean politics, the removal of the sitting president who welcomed that system in. What's coming next and what might it mean for the continued deployment of that system and perhaps others?
The removal of Park Geun-hye a week ago by the Constitutional Court means that there has to be an election in South Korea by May 9th. And if the election were to be held today, then Moon Jae-in of the Minju Party would win. He's a so-called progressive. He's campaigned on against THAAD. I don't know exactly what he would do because he's not the most radical of the progressives, but he has said that THAAD deployment should be decided by the new administration and it should be ratified by the National Assembly, which in practical terms means that it would not be deployed on the peninsula. And it could very well may mean the removal of THAAD. Moon Jae-in has been vague about this. If there were to be a more radical candidate, then I think that the future of THAAD would be extremely cloudy. But it was a good thing that the Trump administration moved quickly to put the initial elements of the THAAD system on the ground at Osan Air Base. It should be deployed on the golf course south of Seoul sometime next month. And this very well may present Moon with basically a fait accompli, and he might not do anything about it. The other thing, of course, is that South Korean politics is extremely volatile. The North Koreans and the Chinese could engage in provocations that could convince the population to vote in another conservative. I'm keeping my fingers crossed. That's not impossible. Moon Jae-in was a senior aide to Noh Moo-hyun, the president who succeeded Kim Dae-jung. Noh Moo-hyun was losing on the morning of Election Day in 2002, but through an internet campaign waged by his supporters starting at noon on Election Day, he actually won. So Moon understands that Korean politics is extremely volatile, and I hope that the Chinese are going to push the South Koreans to end up with a conservative. This is going to be something we need to watch very carefully. We have a lot at stake.
One of the things that's at stake is not just the THAAD program, of course, and the ability that it would represent to defend our allies in South Korea and perhaps Japan as well, but certainly our own forces in the theater, is that more generally this so-called progressive party would resume a very troubling, very fraught, and in fact ultimately failed policy known as the Sunshine Policy. Talk a little bit about that, Gordon Chang, if you would, and how that might complicate further Rex Tillerson's job and that of the United States more generally.
Well, the progressives, and they include a number of different political parties in South Korea, the progressives would clearly want to have a softer policy towards the North. This really is one of their core tenets. The only thing that we can take some comfort in is that most South Koreans right now are wary of North Korea, more so than they've been in the past. This is especially true because of the 50 South Koreans who were killed in 2010, the 46 in the sinking of the Chonan, which is a frigate, and the 4 who were killed in the shelling of Yongpyeongdo, an island. And so there is a limited, I think, flexibility on the part of the public. But nonetheless, there would be a divergence between South Korea and the United States, especially in last year and even in 2015, there was almost no daylight between Seoul and Washington. That was a good thing. Going forward, if we do see a progressive winning in May, it very well may mean, and certainly, almost certainly, going to be Seoul and Washington are going to be disagreeing on Korea policy. This is not pretty when it happens.
Yeah. Gordon, let me ask you about an emerging story. I know that you follow closely the Chinese government and its use of economic wealth capabilities, sometimes as weapons, sometimes to exercise leverage. There is a very substantial investment apparently in the offing by a company called the Anbang Insurance Group based in China that involves the Kushners. That would be, of course, the son-in-law and daughter of the president of the United States. Talk a little bit about what Jared Kushner and his wife Ivanka have prospectively got going here and what its implications might be as well.
Yesterday, Bloomberg issued a very important piece detailing some of the general outlines of a deal between Anbang Insurance and the Kushner companies. Jared Kushner, who is now a special advisor to the president, has said that he's divested out of his family's company. But nonetheless, there are concerns because this deal seems to be extraordinarily favorable to the Kushners and almost commercially unreasonable. And that's an indication that the Chinese central government, Communist Party, are trying to buy off the Trump administration and Trump family. There's also another indication of this, and that is last month China approved 38 trademarks, most of them held by the president himself in his personal capacity. this is a country that is very stingy on granting trademarks to foreigners, and the fact that these 38 were awarded to the president is a real indication of Beijing's attempt to actually just buy the presidency. So therefore, this story that Bloomberg issued about Kushner family comes in the wake of this story about the trademarks. We need to be very concerned. I think that the American public has to ask some pointed questions of the president because this really involves our national security, especially as Trump is planning to meet Xi Jinping, the Chinese ruler, in Mar-a-Lago April 6th and 7th.
We will be watching it closely, as will you. Thanks for your time today, my friend. As always, join us again next week. Hope the rest of you will join us again tomorrow. Same time, same station. Until then, this is Frank Gaffney. Thanks for listening.
From the nation's capital, you've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.